Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Jamie Lee Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quit lit authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. This is Jamie Lee Grace. Hope you've had a great week, and I hope you enjoyed the podcast last week when one of my guests was Sober Dave. And as I promised that I'd tell you what's coming up, and we do now have details of an event that Sober Dave is going to be doing. So I'll tell you about that in a while. If you think I sound a bit odd, it's because I've had a really bad cold. I haven't had a cold in absolutely ages, probably since I stopped drinking, in fact. But, you know, these kind of lurgies get you from time to time, don't they? And it's really knocked me for six. It made me feel really, really rough for a couple of days. So, but, you know, I had to carry on and all of that. So, so that's probably why I might sound a little bit croaky. Not quite my usual sparkly self. Did I tell you that somebody had described my podcast, a lovely review of my podcast, and somebody described my podcast as, they said something like, oh, I really like Janie's podcast because she's got a really unannoying voice. And I thought, I'll take that. That sounds good to me. I have a great guest this week that I've been trailing for a little while. As you know, I'm a really, really big fan of Quit Lit, and I think I've read pretty much all the books out there. I reckon I've read an awful lot of them anyway. I'm quite a voracious reader. And so I've kind of scrolled back and read the old ones as well as the new ones. And this is one of my favourite books. The author is Lisa Smith, and the book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar. And I'm really pleased that Lisa was able to do the interview with me. I have to forewarn you that the quality isn't absolutely the best. You know, sometimes when you do these things, online, and if they're in a different part of the world, and who knows how their sound is, or my sound, or, you know, whatever. So I really hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment. It's not perfect, but hopefully it's good enough to get the message across. It was brilliant to be able to interview Lisa. Just before we get into that, just to mention a couple of things I've kind of picked up on in the press this week. There was another piece about how there have been so many cuts to alcohol rehab services. I mean, this is incredible, really. You know, it's time when you think that they, you know, I mean, where are they going to put investment if not into this kind of thing? And one of the newspapers said that, I think it was on the BBC News online, they said that in their view, it means a national epidemic of alcohol-related problems is not being tackled. That's right. It was research by King's College London. It says, and people with drink problems in England are less than half as likely to receive the right help as those in Scotland and Wales, because more than £100 million has been cut since services in England were reorganised in 2012. Now, this is something that I'd heard about, because when I was doing a little bit of stuff with Alcohol Change UK, a great charity, this is one thing that Richard Piper, the CEO of Alcohol Change UK, it's something that he was talking about, that about the problems with this lack of funding, and, you know, kind of lack of joined up thinking as well. It's I mean, something's just really got to change there, and hopefully, you know, they'll realise, because in Scotland and Wales there has been some investment in alcohol treatment services for people with alcohol dependency, and there's been more access available than to people in England, and it's helped. They've seen the benefits of that. So, you know, there but for the grace of God go any of us, and let's hope that you know, there can be more and more awareness so that people don't get to that stage. But for goodness sake, you know, where are we headed if they can't put the, you know, if they're just cutting the investment, and maybe they can't find masses more money, but you just can't cut these services and kind of hope for the best, really. Anyways, on a completely different note, I also saw in one of the papers a big story that was picked up on how much people spend on a night out. And I thought this was interesting, because obviously I'm I'm working towards putting this this sober club together, and as you know, I really want to make it you know, very accessible and very inclusive, and not, you know, I'm thinking about pricing points. I'm going to make it you know, as low priced as I can, and I was thinking about it a little bit, and then I thought, my goodness, you know, look at what everyone is saving by not drinking. It's incredible. When I look back at what the amount of money I must have saved, I don't dare add it up. But what I so wish I'd done is put the money aside. If you're just starting out on this journey, oh, this is such a top tip. And I know I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again. I so wish I'd done it. A real physical representation. You know, those apps are great where there's apps like I Am Sober, and there's a bunch of them. And you type in what you usually spend on money on alcohol. You have to be honest, of course. It doesn't work otherwise. I don't think I was when I typed mine in. But, you know, you type in how much you spend, and then I don't know, when you're a month sober or whatever, it'll congratulate you and say, yeah, you're 30 days and you've saved X amount of money. And that's really cool, looking at that. But how much better to actually have a physical representation? So get yourself a glass jar or a glass vase and physically put the money in, you know, go and draw the cash out if you would normally buy your alcohol on a card, and stick the notes in the actual, you know, thing. I mean, that is just wonderful to watch that rack up, and then spend that money, you know, on something really that really actually is a treat, something you actually really do want, something that's good for you, something that's perfect for your self-care, or, you know, buy something for someone else. But really value that money that you've saved that would have just been spent on poison. Anyways, this article was a piece, How Much Do You Spend on a Night Out? And I mean, this is just amazing. They did a survey of 2,000 people. It was a nightclub and bar operator who did this survey. And they said people are now spending almost a fifth more on going out than they were this time last year. And the rise, they say, is driven by people who are spending more on pre-drinks, also transport to get home, of course, which again is something you don't necessarily always have to spend as much money on if you're not out drinking till late. And they quote some guy called Callum in this article. It says a blowout night for Callum is £100 to £120. That's unbelievable. And it says his typical spend is below. He's changed it now. That's right. So now he only spends £30 because he's checked himself. But it says his typical spend is well below now the amount that most Britons spend when they go out, which is £70.56. Sounds very specific to me. But what a ridiculous amount of money to spend on just a kind of regular night out. But I guess that's how it will rack up, because you know, by the time you've bought a few rounds of drinks and you know, we know how expensive alcohol is. And then because you've had all that stuff to drink, your food choices are not going to be so good. So you're going to be wanting probably some takeaway rubbish food, and then you're going to need to get your cab home. So, yeah, I can see how that can happen. So let's get into our interview with Lisa Smith, Girl Walks Out of a Bar.
Thank you so much, Lisa Smith, for joining me. I loved your book, Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it's a real joy to be able to chat to you. So welcome, and tell us a bit about yourself, because there will be people who haven't read the book yet, and just back up and tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. First, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be on the podcast.
Thank you.
My story, I am a lawyer in New York City. I don't currently practice law. I'm in administration at a law firm right now. But I am someone who has struggled with substance use disorder, namely alcoholism and cocaine addiction. I wrote a book, my book that you mentioned, Girl Walks Out a Bar, is the story of my descent into and then recovery from sort of what's called high functioning, although I really disagree with that terminology, alcoholism and cocaine addiction, as a lawyer in big New York City firms. And it is, that issue is a kind of rampant one in our profession. And thankfully, we're starting to take a look at at ways we can combat it. But that is just getting underway. But it's an exciting thing that I'm excited to be a part of.
Mm. Why do you think it is so rife in that industry? Or do you think it is actually across all industries, if you like? But, you know, it's something about the pressure, isn't it, really?
It is definitely about the pressure. Sure. It is very much for lawyers like me and who were starting in kind of these giant firms, whether they were U.S. firms or international firms. There is a lot of pressure around what I would call, you know, the billable hour model, about having to bill a certain number of hours each year to qualify for your bonus to stay employed, all of that. It's also a lot, you know, it's a very client-driven profession and clients have demands around the clock. And it is, I think, a particularly tough thing now where, whereas when I was a junior lawyer many years ago, I might be in the office working until 11 o'clock at night. But after I left at 11 o'clock, I would get home, and unless, you know, someone was going to call me on my landline in the middle of the night, I got to disconnect, you know, for those hours until I got back. And now, you know, I don't know of any lawyers really who sleep more than, you know, arm's distance away from their device. They are always connected and expected to be on.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for you then, I mean, you say you were high functioning. So you were, you know, although you said you don't like that phrase, but I'm guessing what you mean is, you know, you were managing to rock up to work every day and you still looked okay. So on the surface, everything was all right. So,
exactly.
But you did in fact have some, you know, fairly rock bottom moments, didn't you? Just talk us through a few of them.
Oh my gosh. Yes. It's funny. I, because this issue has been brought to light so much, I have been able to speak about my experience at a number of law firms. And one of the first things that I do when I speak is say, you know, you might think, say to the lawyers, you might think that, you know, you would know if someone in your midst was under the influence or somehow impaired by alcohol or drugs. And I will tell you that that is not true. And I demonstrate that point by reading a passage from my book. It's a scene where I went to work to an 8:30 a.m. meeting with a group of partners sitting around the table, and none of them had any idea that I had to use, not that I chose to, not that it was something fun for me, but that physically to get to that meeting, I had to drink and then balance it out with cocaine. And that was what I looked like normal sitting in those meetings. But then I had a complete panic in the meeting that I describe in the book, because I realized that I had left a pack of cigarettes that had a baggie of cocaine in it on my office desk. Wow. And I sort of described the experience. I mean, being in that position and being the person who is constantly showing up like that is a miserable, scary, shameful way to exist. And I just remember darting out of that room as soon as I could to make sure that no one had found those drugs in my office. Because, you know, going to the high functioning thing, if that had been discovered, all of a sudden I wouldn't be so high functioning. Mm. All of a sudden it would be like, wow, Lisa's got a really, you know, bad problem and end of career.
Yeah.
So I think the high functioning thing is an illusion, because you really are only high functioning until the day you're not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a slippery slope, isn't it?
Right. You're high functioning and then you get a DUI.
Yeah. And what was, you know, what was the start of the end, as it were? What was there one moment when you just thought, okay, it's got to change. This is it.
There was, I mean, what happened to me was, you know, it had been more than 10 years of a slide down a miserable spiral of, you know, going from drinking just at night to drink, you know, socially to drinking every night, then at lunch. Yeah. And then it got to the point where I couldn't stop my hangovers without drinking in the morning. And, So the last 18 months were really alcohol and cocaine around the clock just to keep functioning.
Yeah.
And it was like a normal Monday morning for me, which meant it was, you know, I had been using alcohol and drugs all weekend and I was on my way to work. I had, you know, checked, I had a mirror that I kept by my door and I looked in the mirror and I checked my teeth for lipstick and then I checked my nose for blood or cocaine. Looked okay, walked out. I had my newspaper, my laptop in my hand and all of a sudden I got this huge overwhelming feeling. And in that moment, I thought that I was either having a heart attack or that I had finally OD'd. And I got terrified. And for all of the mornings that I had woken up sort of wishing that I hadn't woken up,
yeah,
that morning, I suddenly decided, wait a minute, I think I'm going to die. And I don't want to die. I want to live. And I now know that what I was having in that moment was a panic attack, but yeah, that was the moment that made me stop going. You know, I didn't go to work. I turned around and went back into my apartment and I finally said, I need help. You know, because you always think you can get it under control yourself.
Yeah.
I know I shouldn't drink this much, but, you know, I'll get it under control. I know I shouldn't drink in the morning, but I can stop that. You know,
and also because everyone around you is doing pretty much the same thing. So, you know, it seems so normalized.
Yeah.
It's so normalized, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Binge drinking is so normalized. And, you know, that's a lot of what I speak about also is that, you know, the legal field and many others as well. It's not just lawyers, you know, like soaked in alcohol. It's how we recruit. It's how we entertain. It's how we celebrate. It's how we commiserate. Everything is over drinks.
So what did you do? How did you stop? Did you take a conventional route of going to AA? What was it for you?
Well, I didn't know what to do at all. I knew I was sick enough that I would need to have a medicated detox. I knew that it would be dangerous for me to just try to stop using.
Oh, really? I just pick up on that. That's interesting. So how did you know that? Because you literally needed to drink to kind of get through the day, as it were.
Yeah. Because I couldn't get out of bed without drinking. And that had been the case for a long time. And I had read somewhere, you know, how when you're, you know, a lot of people will Google these tests. Like,
am I an alcoholic?
So I had Googled for a long time, like, you know, detox, withdrawal, whatever, trying to figure all that out. And I knew that given the amount and the consistency and how, you know, how I had been doing it for so long, I knew that I was going to need to have a medicated detox because when you're sort of at that point, you are... you could have a heart attack if you just quit. Like the DTs are really, really dangerous. So I knew I would have to get a medicated detox. But I had no sober references. I didn't know anyone who was sober. I didn't know what people did. I had only heard of AA and, you know, that to me seemed like a weird in church basements, you know, drinking that coffee and complaining about their families, which I now know it's not. I love it. But so I called my doctor, my regular doctor, and I said, I need to check into an inpatient detox. And I think I need to do it today. Mm. And he was like, oh, no, you don't. You took your blood, you know, a couple months ago. This is fine.
Really? And that's so interesting, isn't it? What is going on with the medical profession that they're telling us it's fine?
Right, because he didn't realize how much I was drinking at all.
Yeah.
So then he just looked to see where my insurance would cover for me to go in. And I picked a place. And the place I went to, because he didn't know what he was doing either. He was like a gastroenterologist. He was not a detox doctor. And we found a place that took my insurance that could take me immediately. And it turned out to be the worst detox unit in the worst city psych hospital. But I found that out really when I was behind locked doors, lockdown unit. I had to sign myself in on a 72-hour psych hold. And that is part of why really I feel like it's important to raise these issues and things because it didn't have to be that way. I mean, if I had been more knowledgeable or more comfortable asking for help, I could have gotten into, a place that, maybe was better. Although I have to give that place, as scary as it was, I give them all credit because they got my diagnosis, right? And the therapist in there, the psychologist who I had to meet with on a daily basis in there, said to me at the end, he said, I think you are, you've crossed the line. You have a very serious problem. You can't go back. You're not going to be able to drink safely. Mm. But, I think you have a major depressive disorder. And I think you've been self-medicating it all your life. And now you're not going to self-medicate it. And you're going to take appropriate medication to correct that chemical imbalance in your brain. And that's how you'll do that. And you'll enter a long-term program of recovery. And that's how you'll get better. Mm. And it was a relief. It was a relief to learn, that was why I had always felt like this crazy sadness and this, sort of compulsion to drink and to numb out and all of that. So I think, that I got out of there and went to, after 5 days, and started going to an intensive outpatient program at night.
Yeah.
A couple nights a week, I didn't tell my office. I went right back to work, which I also don't recommend. And then I also started going to 12-step meetings right away. And, as soon as I went to 12-step and also went to that outpatient rehab, I was like, oh, okay. Now I get it. There's, these people have brains like mine. And I was surprised at all the laughter and happiness and, the freedom that came with recovery and physically not being sick and not hiding and not lying and all of that. Mm. It was really an amazing thing.
Yeah. And how many years has it been now for you then?
It was 15 years in April.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, knock on wood.
I mean, I know
but
that this
very
is
very much one day at a time.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, I mean, this is the thing I'm finding is that although, I mean, obviously you you're an author and you work in this arena and you're a speaker, so it's very much your life, but even if it weren't, would it still be a thing? If you know what I mean? I'm always intrigued. Is it still like something that you kind of just, you still think about all the time, even in a good way?
Yes. No, I am, basically what it did was helped me, recovery helped me not get sort of, flummoxed or tripped up or obsessive about things I couldn't control. Mm. And it taught me how to just kind of deal with life in a much better way. I mean, I do 12 step, and the first step is, we were powerless over alcohol, and that's the only time alcohol is mentioned. Like the rest of the steps are about, how to sort of change my thinking so that, I can, kind of clean house and be able to go forward in a way that, life isn't this big burden to me and scary and something that I can't handle without substances.
Yeah. I mean, this link between mental health issues, anxiety,
so
depression.
I think that,
sorry, carry on.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, it's definitely, those things happen. I still get depression relapses,
even
on medication, but I know I can feel them and I know what they are. And I know that, I don't try to fight them the way I used to. I sort of say, okay, this is happening. It's going to pass. It has always passed. If it doesn't pass, I'm going to address it with my doctor. It's going to be okay. Mm. Like there's a different faith in things being okay that I have now. And I don't, it's like when I look at drinks, like people like, oh, I wish I could drink. I don't, people will often ask, like, do you miss having a drink at dinner? Mm. And I think I never really had a drink at dinner. I had multiple drinks at dinner.
Yeah.
And then I would, and maybe if I decided, oh, I think I can have, a drink with dinner, maybe that would last for some period of time, but I know myself that inevitably I can't handle alcohol safely and I will end up going back. And, a lot of the freedom that comes from it is from the mental obsession. My entire life was revolved around, you know, when I was going to be able to drink, how I was going to hide it, how I could, you know, keep that lifestyle up. It's way more exhausting to be drinking all the time and hiding it than it is to be sober. It's way more work.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so I don't look at it as something that, you know, I think I could ever kind of enjoy safely, because I know if I had one drink, I'd just be thinking about the next.
Yeah.
And that's not how I want to live my life. And I get to make that choice now.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to make that choice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to imagine when you're still drinking that you'll ever not feel that desire.
No, and there's terrible fear around it too.
Terrible fear.
Because you can't imagine that desire will go away. Mm. I really didn't believe it when they told me in the beginning that desire would go away, but it does.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you get flashes of things where, you know, to me, it's not like, you know, I wish I could drink because I miss the taste of wine, or I'm, you know, because, you know, mojitos weren't a thing when I was drinking, so I never drank a mojito. Mm-hmm. But like, it's not like I think about it like that. What comes back is sometimes the desire to kind of shut my brain down, you know, to escape.
Yeah.
And that's what the alcohol did. That's what I miss sometimes. But now recovery has given me sort of tools to deal with that feeling and to get through that feeling, you know, without blowing up my life, which is what drinking would do.
Of course. So now in the work that you do, and particularly when you engage with other people in business, other people, you know, other lawyers or whatever, what's the main message that you're trying to get across to them? Is it that you're trying to encourage them to look again at their relationship with alcohol?
I think it's more about, you know, like I said, I had an undiagnosed co-occurring mental health disorder, depression that I had been self-medicating.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it is more about trying to break the stigma around these things and understanding, like even the American Bar Association has said, to be a good lawyer, you have to be a healthy lawyer. And that means mental health and as well as physical health, but also the mental health. And that I try to say that we need to treat these things as the, you know, brain diseases that they are, as the U.S. Surgeon General has said about addiction. And, you know, my hope is that more people, like I was terrified to seek help when I was in it, because one, what we talked about with, you know, how could it possibly be that I won't need this in my life? And two, what other people would think of me? Would they think I was somehow defective or weak or, you know, not reliable? And I try to, you know, get across the one thing I want them to know is that, you know, if I had a heart condition, I'd go to a cardiologist. And if I broke my leg, I would go to an orthopedic surgeon. I have a chemical imbalance in my brain and I need to treat that so that, you know, I can right that and engage in the world without using substances. And we have to treat these brain issues the same way we treat physical issues and not think of them differently. That is sort of what I try to get across. And I mean, I do think that, you know, I always say I'm not trying to, tell people, you know, alcohol is evil or there shouldn't be alcohol in the legal profession. It's much more about, people like alcohol, but let's be a little bit more intentional about it. And let's also understand that today, and I see them all the time, young lawyers, law students, there are so many more people who don't drink alcohol just as a choice. They either, you know, sometimes there are religious reasons people don't drink alcohol.
Yeah,
there are also
yeah.
dietary reasons, or they, you know, they don't, it doesn't agree with them, or they have seen it, you know, destructive in families and choose to just stay away from it. Alcohol is the only drug, and it is a drug that we have to somehow justify not taking when we, you know, to other people. And we need to shift that. So not saying, you know, wipe out alcohol from functions, but saying like there are things we can do even to start around the edges. Like we had a very big firm celebration last month, and you know, we had a signature cocktail for it. It was on a Wednesday night, and we also had a signature mocktail. So when people walked into the room, we had a virgin mojito, as it was.
Yeah, right.
When people walked into the room, they were told, you know, here's the margarita thing, and also here's the virgin mojito. Mm. So many people grabbed the virgin mojito, and I heard so many comments about, oh, I'm so glad you had this because I really didn't want to drink tonight. Not everybody drinks every night. Like, people get on the train to go home to their kids and do homework. Mm. People, like, you know, limit their drinking to weekends because they just don't like it that much. We need to just make it so that not every activity is about alcohol. Not every, you know, it shouldn't be incumbent upon the people who sort of struggle with these issues to change the culture. The bigger culture needs to change around it. And it's, you know, everybody's involved. Everybody has a stake in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So finally then, Lisa, what are you working on at the moment, and what would you like to see happen? Let's say I interview you in a year's time. What would be your fairy godmother dream, if you like, for this scene?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that, because I'm actually going to be leaving. I've been working in law firms, both, you know, well, as a lawyer and then on the administrative side in business development, and in the role I've been in for the last 5 years as a deputy executive director in full-time legal job. Mm-hmm. And I'm leaving that at the end of August, because I'm actually going to start a consultancy to work with law firms and law schools and bar organizations and other legal employers on these issues. The American Bar Association has issued this challenge to all legal employers, and law schools are signing it too, to take this pledge to advance attorney well-being. And it's got a 7-point framework, and it lays out, you know, the kinds of programs that firms and other legal employers should be, if a firm chooses to sign this pledge, which a lot have, what they should be doing to comply with it. So I want to work, my hope in a year is that I am actually working with some firms on their compliance and helping them, you know, make the most of what they can in doing, executing on what they said they would do with the pledge, and, you know, hopefully giving them insight from my experiences, and also helping them identify resources that are going to, you know, be of value to them and to their attorneys.
Amazing. Well, let's hope then. Let's hope that you get your messages out there.
We'll see. Yeah.
It's great to chat to you, Lisa, and thank you for an amazing book that's still doing amazing work after some time. You know, it goes on and on, doesn't it? It's brilliant.
Knock on wood. Yes. It really means a lot to me. I wrote it because I felt so alone in my addiction, and I wanted the next person to know that they're not alone. Really, the first time I heard from somebody that, you know, it helped them, I was like, okay, my work here is done.
Got
what I wanted out of it. So I feel really grateful for it.
Great.
And thank you for having me. This has been lovely.
Thank you, Lisa. And if you come to London, look us up. We have events and stuff. So be lovely to have you.
Oh, I would love it.
Right.
Thank you so much. Let me know if you come to New York.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Okay.
So grab yourself a copy of the book. I'm going to have a list soon of my favourite books. I'm going to have to work quite hard to put that together, because, as I say, I've read so many, but I'll have that ready for you soon. I promised I'd tell you about the event that Sober Dave, who was my guest on the podcast last week, has organised, and we've just kind of helped him a bit, really, because Dave is a big Instagram influencer, if you like. Sober_Dave_today is his Instagram handle. Mine is @JamieLeeGrace, as I'm sure you know. So Sober Dave has wanted to kind of get together lots of people on Instagram, because it's amazing, actually, the sober community there. I mean, I think it is across social media generally, but Instagram particularly seems to be great for people who are ditching the booze or have decided to do that and want to really focus on, you know, what's next, the rest of their lives. And so Dave has been kind of wanting to get a bunch of people together, and he was looking at doing some kind of lunch, and it's all ended up and come full circle, and so he's now working with myself and Rachel, who run the charity My Yard, and we do our self-care for the Sober Curious events, and we actually didn't have another one planned But Dave kind of hijacked it and said, well, okay, let's do my thing. So we said, all right. So we've got Sober Dave's Saturday Afternoon Social. And it's going to be at the Jago, which is the venue that we always use in Dalston in London. But the good news is it is a Saturday afternoon social. So for once, it's not a Monday night. So if weekends work for you, perhaps this is the one you'll be able to make. So it's Saturday, 7th of September. To get tickets, you have to go to Eventbrite. And if you type in self-care for the sober curious, as usual, then you'll find it. It will come up under that. Or you can type My Yard, which is the name of the charity. And again, it will come up under one of their events. And we'll put the link as well in the show notes for the podcast. So this one does have a ticket price because there's lunch provided. There's a light lunch going to be provided. I can't remember exactly how much it is. It's around £10. The really cool news is that Rock Sober are sponsoring this. Rock Sober were guests on the podcast ages ago when I first started. And in fact, they were on the podcast before they'd even launched their alcohol-free beer. So that's going to be available at the event, of course. And obviously, there'll be other alcohol-free drinks for people who don't drink beer. And there might be some live music, and I am going to, Dave is obviously his thing, but I'm going to pop up and launch the Sober Club, which is my new thing. So it's going to be a really cool afternoon, I hope. If you haven't signed up yet for the waiting list of the Sober Club, please do, because I'm going to invite the first bunch of people to join the kind of beta version, if you like, the launch, the pre-launch, if you see what I mean, where it maybe every single thing isn't finished yet, but where, we're going to sort of get it rocking. And we'll get your feedback and for the privilege of being part of it from the beginning, it will be a super discounted rate. So it would be great to have you involved. So just all you need to do is go to thesoberclub.com and give us your email address. Obviously, no obligation whatsoever. We'll send you a little PDF of self-care tips, and then you'll be on the waiting list for when I've got more news to share with you. I am working on it all behind the scenes, although having this cold has really knocked me back. It really makes you feel huge gratitude for when you do feel 100% well, doesn't it, when you get something going on. So really hope that some of you will be able to join us for Dave's Saturday Afternoon Social, Saturday 7th of September. My self-care tip this week feels very relevant after my having my cold, is sleep. Get enough sleep. I mean, that sounds blatantly obvious, doesn't it? But you forget how often we push ourselves and we just don't get the right amount of sleep. And we know we read all this stuff about sleep hygiene. I mean, it's such a daft word, but I think it's kind of obvious. The obvious things are make sure your bedroom is cool enough. That can be difficult in the summer in the UK. But it's really important, I think, to have the right temperature. And then don't have electronic stuff in your bedroom. I don't even know if I've ever even said that on this podcast before, but I'm very conscious of electromagnetic frequencies and just what on earth we're doing to ourselves with all this tech. And of course, it's fantastic, and none of us want to give it up. I'd be the last person who wants to give up my mobile phone, but I'd never have it in the bedroom. And I know that doesn't work for everyone, but at the very, very least, turn your phone off, put your phone on airplane mode. Don't do that thing where you have a, you know, phone to wake you up like an alarm clock. Just get an alarm clock, you know, old fashioned alarm clock. But put your phone on airplane mode, and preferably don't have laptops and computers in there if you can possibly help it, because actually this is when we need to restore. And if you're in the early stages of ditching the booze, oh my goodness, sleep is not the easiest. It doesn't necessarily come easy at the beginning. I was really hoping when I gave up that I'd immediately sleep like a baby. And it really did not happen, probably for a good 6 weeks, actually. It's so well worth it when it does. But you've got to get through that period of your sleep being really quite disrupted. Your body doesn't know whether you're coming or going. So you know, you've got to bear with that and get through it. And, you know, be kind to yourself. And there is this theory, isn't there, that if you really can't get to sleep, then it's better to sort of get up for a while, rather than kind of lie there agonizing. get up and, you know, make yourself a cup of herbal tea or whatever. But don't start doing anything that stimulates your brain again too much. So I definitely wouldn't put the news on or anything like that. And I think, you know, this is one area where meditation and visualization apps and tapes can really work. You know, having said no technology in your room, actually some kind of audio meditation download, maybe one of the hypnotherapy tracks from Ailsa Frank. Ailsa Frank is one of the guests on the podcast, a hypnotherapist, and she's got some fantastic, you know, hypnosis audios, several of them around drinking. She's going to be involved in the Sober Club. So I'm definitely going to be talking more about Ailsa's work. But that's the kind of thing that can really help just put you into a different state and just calm your mind down. And while I'm talking teas, by the way, I've got my Platinum Awards going on at the moment, which is the natural products that I promote. And I've got some amazing products entered. And one of the products that's come through is a company called Chuckling Goat. They do amazing goat's milk kefir and skincare. But they also have this new product, which is a tea. It's called Sing Me to Sleep Tea. I mean, it's worth it for the name alone, right? But we're not talking tea bags here. We're talking proper tea, the real deal, you know, roots and herbs and flowers. And you have to kind of brew this tea. Smells gorgeous, tastes really lovely, and it's really calming. They recommend you have a cup, you brew it and you have a cup a couple of hours before bedtime, and then one maybe just before bed. So give that a try. Oh, while I'm talking about the Platinum Awards, by the way, the entries have closed technically, but you can still vote for products, and we do have an alcohol-free section in there. So there are a few brands who've entered the awards. Off the top of my head, Sea Arch have definitely entered with their fabulous alcohol-free alternative to gin, their lovely botanical drink. I know that Nonesuch Shrubs have entered as well, and really looking forward to trying their. They've got like a sparkling drink, which looks amazing. We're looking forward to trying that. Jeffrey's Tonics have entered. So there's a whole bunch of these drinks. So do check that out. And if you get an opportunity, if you see anything on social media and you get an opportunity to vote for them, that would be great. And we're going to have a pop-up shop. It's not linked to the alcohol-free stuff particularly, but mostly for the skincare and home and organic natural skincare and beauty products that that I recommend. We're going to be having a pop-up shop in London from the 9th to the 15th of September. So if that's your thing, or if you're maybe now you're getting sober, starting to get interested in all things natural, then put those dates in the diary. 9th to the 15th of September, there'll be a pop-up shop at Hello Love in London, where we'll have a whole bunch of these fabulous, you know, eco-friendly, natural, organic alternatives to skincare and beauty products, and a few supplements, and a few bits and bobs for the home as well. That went off on a tangent, didn't it? Anyways, looking forward to some of my guests coming up in future shows. I'm going to be interviewing Kira Jean Roberts, who is a naturopath. Got some interesting views and some great tips. A whole bunch of other guests coming up. Don't forget that I love getting your feedback. If there's anyone you'd like me to interview, then please make a suggestion. Or if you just want to tell me how you're getting on or ask a question, you're very welcome. It's at Janie Lee Grace on all the social media stuff. If you're on Facebook, at Janie Lee Grace Loves. And you can always drop us an email as well, janie@janieleegrace.com. And as I've already mentioned, if you go to thesoberclub.com, it's not a website yet, just a landing page where you can fill in your email address. And a reminder, that event is Saturday, 7th of September with Sober Dave. It's the Saturday afternoon social. It's self-care for the sober curious on Eventbrite. I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast with Janie Lee Grace. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us, share on social media, and tune in again.